Shoot the defense, the best podcast in the world. We're out here.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know, it was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, that's sending a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to another podcast from Ukrafoot 24. A big thank you, as always, to Stell at Shoot the Defence for giving me the opportunity to put this out. Really happy today to have Dev with me. Dev has been working really hard on a new addition to football literature. It's a very interesting concept that I'm looking forward to finding out more on later today. But Dev, it's great to have you with us today. How are you doing over there?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Adam. Great to be here as well, mate. Thanks for reaching back out after I reached out to you. It's definitely a time to make sure we all keep networking, make sure we all keep sane. And especially when you're doing something as strenuous as a book, it's really important to keep sane as much as you can. So delighted, mate. But yeah, everything's good, my end. Busy as ever, if not a bit more now. But better busy than bored, I guess.
It certainly is. So where did your passion for football all come from?
I think it's been as long as I can remember. I can't nail down a specific time when I fell in love with football, but there was a player who, as many of us, we always had our heroes growing up. And even though I love, like, back in my time, I was born in 97, got into football maybe when I was 3 or 4, apparently my dad says. And you know, I love Ronaldinho, I love Beckham, Ruud van Nistelrooy, those kind of players. I'm a United fan as well. But for some reason, even though he wasn't the best at our club, Diego Forlan was my guy. For no real reason, I just thought he looked cool. He always scored good goals. He had a headband on, looked a bit stylish. I just loved him. Like, I actually just loved Forlan. So, and then he bagged 2 against Liverpool and I was like, yeah, I love him even more. But since then, it just sprouted, really. I was always quite an academic, studious kind of person. So after realising I was okay at playing, I was a decent keeper, but just didn't have... You know, some people, when they always say, yeah, I could have been a good footballer, but, you know, I got an injury, you know, done my leg in, done this. Not me, mate. I just wasn't good enough. I was not good enough. And so I took a kind of back role and was like, you know, let's analyse it, let's study it, let's do what other people perceive as boring, but just what I find interesting. So fully-fledged football nerding capabilities came around secondary school, and since then it's just evolved into the book, I guess, which is the ultimate sort of evolutionary practice for it. So yeah.
What is it that interests you in the more sort of academic side of it? You know, what kind of got you the bug?
Well, I never like taking things on face value. I've always thought there's something more to everything we see. And it's not like in a conspiracy type way, but in some instances it can be. But just when you see the final article, I'm just always interested in how things got to that level. And sort of, you know, you just got 11 guys for one team on a pitch versus 11 guys from another team kicking a ball about. But then how the hell does that draw 100,000 people to a stadium or billions worldwide? I just didn't, like, where's the connect? So I just wanted to find out what that was. And not just that, but sort of because we're not really told much about football, like what goes on in the boardroom or the dressing room or whatever. And yet you'll see Amazon do these fly on the wall documentaries and all these different things that, you know, we don't get to see. And it just takes off because we're all naturally interested in what we don't know or what we're unable to see. So it was just kind of that, just the intrigue of what can I find out? What do they not want us to know? What can I, you know, search deeper into? What can I link together? And then the book just kind of came from that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you completely. My early memories were from sort of the 86 World Cup. in particular, and sort of the ticker tape entrances got me fascinated about the global game, not just the game back home in the UK, shall we say. So what do you think it is, you know, that sort of connects us all then through football? What, you know, what do you believe is that sort of fundamental thing, concept, shall we say, that, you know, gets every so many people excited about the game around the world?
I just think because it's so simple. There aren't really many barriers to entry when it comes to football. You get down to the nitty-gritty, okay, the offside rule could be a little less complicated and this could be a little bit easier to understand. But at the end of the day, it's just a bunch of lads got a ball there, you've got to kick it in one net or you kick it in the other net. That's like the main part of it. It's a simple scoring system unlike a few different sports. It's simple in terms of like who wins in a knockout competition. It's got like variations to it. But also because it's rooted in local communities, I think it's done something which a lot of sports don't do, because whether it's racing or with tennis or singular sports stars, you're rooted to the person as opposed to that club or to that community. And with football, because it began so humbly as well, it's never lost that sense of community feel about it, and it's led to rivalries and sort of unsavory things that, you know, we perhaps don't really like when the two come together. But at the heart of it, it's just something that you can switch your mind off, hard week's work, something to do on the weekend, something that's always present, something that never lets you down, and you just keep going and keep going and going. So I think it's just the simplicity in it that allows people to get on board so easy.
Do you think it's that simplicity, shall we say, one of the reasons? You just got me thinking about the US, and all credit to the MLS more recently. But do you think it's that kind of that pure nature of the game, why it hasn't took off in certain parts of the world, like, you know, North America up to 20 years ago, that kind of, you know, has stopped it reaching certain areas that perhaps like more complex characteristics in life?
Maybe, and I know that the US, the MLS does that East and Western conference thing that they do in NBA and other sports, which kind of divides the country, in my opinion. I think it's, I can see why logistically they have to do that kind of thing, but really, if you're unable to play a certain team somewhere else and, you know, on a regular basis and kind of compete and see who's better and cause upsets and get these moments, you sort of just come to a point where it's the elite of one versus the elite of another, and it loses that kind of feel to it. Whereas you see Burnley going up to Newcastle, and you see Manchester United coming down to London, you just see it all intertwined with each other. So that's probably why the US struggled. But you know, the US is a particular case in point, because they tried it all these years back with the NASL, and then that got disbanded, and then they brought in the MLS for I think like 20 years later or something. So it's different for them, but definitely in other parts of the world, that segregation bit, I think they shouldn't be doing that if they can help it. And then you'll probably get some of the diehards of our country, or indeed most of Central Europe, who take to the game like it does. But yeah, I think that's it. And also a lot of these countries come in quite late on the scene, because we've had football forever, same with Central Europe, but then India and Asia and the US as well, they kind of came in later. So I think they already had that stigma. It was like, well, let's just jump on the bandwagon as opposed to letting it grow organically. But that could all change. I think that could change with time and with new generations and with talent developing there as opposed to retiring there, which is what it seems to be. And then we might see a bit of a difference, but it's going to be a long time, I guess, until we see that.
Let's hope so. Let's hope so. How do your friends and family take to your academic love of football?
It's hard to answer that, because I don't talk too nerdily about football with many people, because it can alienate people sometimes. Like, I'm a fully fledged nerd, and I'm proud of that. I like the weird stuff that people don't usually like, or don't claim to like anyway. And it's like, when I can't sit there with my dad and watch United play and say, oh, did you know that this stadium was built in, you know, this year, and then we had to do this commercial activity with this brand to get he won't care, but we'll sit there, watch the game and have fun and do what we always do. So I tend to not really talk about this sort of thing with many people. And in fact, one of the reasons for writing the book entirely was because I was having a conversation with my girlfriend, and she just, her eyes glazed over whenever I went off on a tangent. And I was like, you know what, fair enough, you're not into it, it's not for me to like push it on you or anything, so how about I do something else? And I guess the most elaborate form of talking to yourself is writing a book. So I just kind of let all of my knowledge out onto a page. It started with a bullet list of all these different things, and then various ideas came about, and it matured into, you know, what we'll come to talk about, I guess. But that's kind of where it all came from, because I just didn't, yeah, I couldn't really connect with many people on that level, I guess. A lot of my friend group or anything like that. And it just kind of came from this need to get this information out of me at some point. So I guess that's what it came to, yeah.
It's some, you know, some fantastic concepts you come up with in the book. So what would you say was sort of, you know, you mentioned the bullet points there of the your knowledge and the information that you've gathered over the years. What was sort of the leaping off point with the book? Where did that, apart from glazed over eyes from the girlfriend, you know, was there any kind of trigger there?
Yeah, there was actually. So I was watching I was listening to a podcast with The True Geordie, like a famous UK podcaster. And he had David Icke on, who is the famous conspiracy theorist, to talk about his book. And he said one of the reasons for writing his, which was looking into the backstory of 9/11 and other conspiracies, was that he said, if you look at any moment in history and you choose to isolate it and just look at it as it is, you will see it as nothing else but a moment in history. But then when you take a step back and you realize the chain of events leading up to it and the ones that sprouted from it, you begin to realize it's part of this like really convoluted structure that all pieced together to explain something much bigger than us. And he said that he was pointing out the conspiracy angle and pointing out very key human, like historical points in history. But I was like, I wonder if sport has its own thing. Like, I wonder if football, over a period of time, if we look at moments and we take a step back and we see what came from it and what led up to it, if we could have a story here that actually correlates with each other. Mm. And as I was writing the points down that I thought were major points in history, I saw some links, and then some came up in the research, some developed through talking to people, and then it just all pulled together. So it doesn't bring together everything, because I don't think that's possible, but it certainly brings together some key significant points that, because you look at the game from 50 years ago, which is when the book starts, to now, it's chalk and cheese, like it's night and day. So it's good for just people to understand how we got to where we are, because I think it's a good springboard to understand where we could be heading as well. So that's kind of pulling it all together, I guess. So yeah, David Icke, True Geordie, that was the day he said that is when it kind of, you know, bulb flickered, and then I just started writing points down.
Ah, great. That's absolutely fantastic. And you say 50 years ago was your starting point. Wonderful. Yep. 1970, the World Cup with perhaps one of the greatest World Cup teams of all time. Do you sort of subscribe to that belief that the Brazilian team, especially in the final, put on one of the greatest performances ever seen in international football?
Yeah, because it's if we were just to go like for like, player for player, they're up there as one of the best ever teams, but probably 2010 Spain era, I've got to put that up there as well, with the tiki-takas and everyone there. But for their era, just how they changed everything and how they approached the game, which is so much fun and everything, because the game wasn't all that fun back then. It was very, you know, systematic, simple, get the ball up, do this, do that. And they just flipped it on its head and became what it is. So to adopt that in a game of that significance, in a tournament of that significance, knowing that you've got pedigree already, it was something to watch. But the best, I'm not sure. Because I wasn't there to see it, or that wasn't at my time of watching it. Like, I can watch back as much as I can, but I still got to give Spain's team of the 2010s the edge over them. I just have to, just because of how pivotal they were. But they're up there. I'd sway easily on either way with that one. I wouldn't be too bad if I debated that with someone and they won Brazil like that. Yeah, that was a great team for sure.
I mean, I personally, the 82 World Brazilian World Cup team were the greatest team.
Yeah.
Never to win the World Cup, shall we say? I can sit back and look at those highlight reels for hours of that tournament. Absolutely fantastic football. So, can you give the listeners a few little snippets? How does the book journey through them from 1970 to today?
Sure. So it does go throughout world football. It touches not just the Prem, but also it starts in the Old English First Division. It goes through to Holland. It goes to Italy, Spain, Asia, and Australia and the US. So it goes through, well, it is global. It's pretty much a global sort of journey through. But the very first point is I wanted to look and see what manager really encouraged a different style of play. I told you before, it was very physical, it was very demanding, it was this, but who wanted to change the fabric of their football club to make it more renowned? Because clubs were just kind of happy to be where they were at the point, but then Man United was starting to change things. And if not for the Munich Air disaster, I think I probably would have started with them, because I think their legacy would have beaten a lot of the teams I did end up talking about. But Leeds and Liverpool, at the time, Shankly and Revy were changing the game in terms of how the game was played in a way they were a bit more fluid, a bit more fun to watch. But technically and tactically, they were very good at studying the opposition, which a lot of managers never really used to do, or at least never proclaimed that they were very good at doing. And then when I was talking about Revy, it just seemed good to talk about Clough and the issues that Revy and Clough had, but also contrasting some of the issues that they had. But in between the two of them, you had one of English football's first first televised rivalries that brought football into the mainstream. So it wasn't just football fans anymore. It was, if you don't want to tune in to watch Derby at the time or Leeds play, then maybe you can watch these two just take the piss out of each other, which they did regularly. Even though they made it more interesting as a sort of entertainment product, I don't think they did really much to change how the game was played. It was still one-dimensional, still very physical. And, I mean, Leeds were called Dirty Leeds, and Clough's Derby, he didn't stay there long enough to do what he should have done because he fell out with the board. So what player was most influential at that time for changing the script was Cruyff. And that's when we take it to Holland. And Cruyff himself, his own tale of events and what came before and after him, is really what set the tone for the rest of the book. If I'm honest, he's one of the main reasons I wrote it, because I've never liked people who ask me, who's the greatest player of all time? Who's the greatest that? Because if I'm honest, I don't think it's a question that I'll ever get an answer, because it's flawed. And I write this in the book. I say, if we were to have this conversation, Adam, and I said to you, who do you think is the greatest player to ever play? And you ask me the same thing. We're probably going to come up with different answers, but that's probably because you will have a set of characteristics or attributes that you think makes the player great. And they might differ from mine. So I might say goal tally or physicality. You might say skill, invention. And then you might get Messi, I might get Ronaldo. That's sometimes how it comes about. But I ask more specific questions like, who's the best goal scorer? Who's the best athlete? Who's the best or most influential player of all time? And for me, the most influential player, bar none, is Johan Cruyff. Because with Total Football and with the Netherlands brand, he changed everything. So he is one of the focal points for the book, and he gets referenced a lot. And away from the kind of how the game was played, you have the commercial side. How did it go from the First Division to the Prem? What happened with the MLS, kind of the rise and death and rebirth of the MLS? What we can expect to see from Asia and Australia in their form, but also how various takeovers around the world had success and didn't have success, but how they all link. So Galacticos, Mansour, Rovers with Jack Walker, QPR, because they thought they were going to do something great. And all these other teams. So they all mesh in with one another, and there's a few linking points, usually with player transfers or managerial moves, that shift the tide from one to the other. And that's kind of how it all takes.
Well, I was certainly looking forward to having a look at it in the future, definitely.
Yeah, for sure.
Where do you see football going from this point then? Now, as you've mentioned, how everything's kind of interlinked, do you see football heading in a distinct direction?
Yeah, I see it becoming not a physical game, but a very physically demanding game, even more than it is now, because it just keeps getting quicker. And different leagues around the world are innovating in ways that we don't even know. So you have people going into cryo chambers to get fit. You have them using FIFA and Football Manager stats, because they've got some of the best stats around, just to judge how they're going to play and judge how they're going to go and develop and all this. You've got data analysis, nutritionalists, fitness experts who now get integrated into every single football team or elite football team. So I think that's all going to just make the game even more exciting and even more physically demanding to watch, to the point where I think there'll be a tougher barrier to entry now to get into the elite levels of football. So I think it'll be more fun. It'll be complicated, perhaps, to watch, more strategic than it has been before. You can even see the Premier League. A lot of the teams now are very technically gifted teams and not hoof the ball up and hope. It's like, I don't think Burnley are going to last very much longer doing that, for example, but that's one of the things. But I think we'll see a lot more competition as well from other leagues. We've seen Alphonso Davies come out of the MLS. There's clearly a good production factory there somewhere. We've seen Aaron Moy come out of Australia. I think there'll be more there too. So I think we're just going to see a greater amount of talent. But that's hoping that Brexit and obviously COVID-19 doesn't do too much to restrain that. I don't know what that's going to look like, but if all else goes well, it's just going to get more and more advanced, and I don't think it'll ever come down from that level.
As you mentioned, I was going to mention COVID. How do you feel will footballers cope with the COVID challenge?
To be honest, I wasn't all that happy with Project Restart when it came about, because I just felt it was my own naivety, I guess, because I just thought, well, people are dying here, and you're now asking all these guys to put that to one side. Like, they've got families, they've got this, they're going to come into contact with people, and they've got, God forbid, we did Project Restart and someone caught it and someone died from it. Like, that was how cynical I was being with it. But then you think, like, the Premier League and other leagues, they're a product, it's a company, it's a business, and it needed to happen, because otherwise clubs would have gone down. We probably would have brought the transfer market to a bit of a standstill, so the prices would have gone down. But you lose jobs, you cause unemployment, you cause a lot of mental issues, I know, with people who struggled without football being there. But then what happens to the commentators? What happens to the freelancers, the reporters, the journalists? Everyone associated gets affected. So I guess, less of two evils, you kind of had to have it back. Excuse me. But overall, I think they were quite mature. They waited their time to do it. At the beginning, everyone was like, what's going on? And they probably waited a bit too long in hindsight. But now that the Prem's back and all the leagues are back, to not have fans in on the first day of the season, I just don't agree with. As a purist, I don't agree with it. I think they could have forced it back and made for next summer to be harder while everyone's getting adjusted to it, because they haven't had long off. To have the transfer window a month into the season, I think is just wrong. That was the whole point of, stopping it before the season starts last year, which worked brilliantly. I don't know what that's going to do to January. I don't know what that's going to do to next year and the Olympics and and Euros is next year as well. So I think they've had a bit of a mess with the scheduling, but only time will tell, I guess. I just wish they'd considered extending it a bit and making it something to look forward to, because I wasn't even that much looking forward to the new season. It was just another day. So, yeah, I hope to see fans back. I don't know when we'll see that, if ever, for this season. But, yeah, we need them back. We just do.
We definitely do. It doesn't seem quite right watching these empty stadiums. I just want to touch on one thing you mentioned there. Earlier on, you were talking about the fact that, you know, one of the reasons football success is that it is so simple and so pure in its format. And we sort of, you know, as we've discussed there, one of the reasons Project Restart has come about is that at the top elite level of the game, it is so commercialised that it almost became compulsory that the league had to find a way in order to fulfil all its legal obligations and clubs not to go bankrupt. Do you get nostalgic for the old days?
As in for how the game used to be?
Used to be, yeah.
No, I don't, to be honest, because I respect it, I guess, and it is a business, and that's kind of how it forms. But I was born into the Premier era, so I don't really know what the First Division was really like in week in, week out. Because for me, to now have all games at 3 o'clock and to have everything scheduled at X amount of time just feels odd to me. So it is a bit of a weird one, but I wouldn't exchange how exciting the Premier League still is and how visible it is across the world if it means getting back to that level of purity, because I think that's what makes it as grand as it is and why it's such a good talking point. And to be honest, I think that's why I find it so interesting, because it's multifaceted. It's not simple. It's different. It's complicated. It's hard to understand, like, from that side of things. And I think that's what brought nations in. It's what gives everyone a bit of a lift. It's what, like, really promotes the sport more than anything. The game of football needs a commercialist aspect to profit and to do well. And also with that, there's good benefits from it being commercial. So, like, the jobs I mentioned that people could have lost during COVID, a lot of them haven't, and those jobs wouldn't even exist without football. And the money it brings in allows it to do good for the community. It allows it to bring in a lot of revenue to the surrounding area if they choose to elect to do that. I know Man City have probably been one of the best at doing that, and as a United fan, I'm ashamed to say United aren't as good in the past years, but City have 10 different training grounds. They've put 5 different hotels up, 2 different blocks of flats, lowered the renting, lowered everything just because they can. And that's a beautiful thing. And it's something I wish I saw Newcastle do if that takeover went ahead. I think there's so many benefits to it. So no, I don't think I'd exchange this version of football for anything, I don't think.
Yeah, that's good to hear. Yeah. So what's the plan now with the book? What stage are you at with it in its development?
Well, I want to say it's pretty much finished now. So I started writing it probably back in December 2019. And because it's going to be self-published, I've reached out to a bunch of publishers, but looking at the figures and looking how much I'd lose out of going with a publisher, I didn't want that for my very first book, at least. If I decide to write another one and I get a good following from this or a good standpoint in this, in terms of how books are written I can work off the reviews and whatever, then I can revisit that. But for now, I'm going self-published. It's going to be on Amazon. So it's going to be on Amazon Prime and Amazon Kindle, direct publishing. And the way it will work is that I just upload the manuscript. I do the cover art. They process it to order and it goes like that. So there'll be a pre-order link, which I expect will go up in about a month's time, because I've ordered a copy for myself just to make sure everything's all in line, and once I'm happy with it, it'll be up pretty much straight away. So I'd imagine for the pre-order link, that'll be available in about a month, and official launch date is the 1st of December 2020. So that'll be the day that people can get them, hopefully in time for Christmas. That'll be a nice little thing to have over the Christmas break. And so it's exciting, but it's hot, it's tough work, and it's a lot of like, have you heard of imposter syndrome before?
I haven't, no.
So it's this thing where when you're doing something big or something that's like a big project or something, you begin to, like, you do well and you give it a go and whatever. But then I look at it and I look at the fact, God, I'm writing a book. Who the hell am I to be writing a book? Just at a random point, I just think, I've said something about Thierry Henry, Johan Cruyff. Who the hell am I to say something about Johan Cruyff and Thierry Henry? But then you kind of put that to one side and you realise what you're there to do, and it's all out of respect and it's all out of investigation, journalism and whatever. So a lot of that came into play. But now I think I've pushed past that, and I'm happy to say that it's just at the right level for me to finally go out and do it. So now I'm just reaching out to people like yourself, to fellow podcasters and influencers, but also just people who are interested in it and can, like, a simple tweet, a simple repost share would mean the world to me if ever I get that from whoever it is, because it's all good stuff at the end of the day. And I don't have a certain limit that I want to get to, a certain sales limit, a money target. I don't really care about that. I just never thought I could do it, and here I am with it. So even if it's just bought by one person who I don't know, who has just come across it and bought it and thought it was good, that's enough for me. Just one. But, you know, 1 million would be great too, but just the one would be fine. But yeah, I'm at the good stage now. I'm at the advanced stages. So just pure marketing and pure getting the name out there, getting the book out there until December. And then I'd like to say I'd rest after that, but I don't think I will. There'll probably be another one. So
No chance on that. So yeah, you mentioned there about retweets and the like. What's the best way for people to get in touch with you there?
I'd say Twitter and Instagram and even LinkedIn. LinkedIn I use a lot of. My name on LinkedIn is Dev Badger, so that's pretty easy for people to keep in mind. But the Twitter handle and the Instagram handle are my full first names. So it's A-M-M for mother, A-N for never, D-E-V. And it's just at Amandev, every single social media that I have. So that's where I upload all of the information about the book, the launch, where I'm at with it, where people can get the promo link. And I also have my own website called sportscripture.com, which is, as it probably denounced, there's like a lot of stories, sports stories, all in one place. And there's a page in there called Book Launch, which gives you that same information. But for all social users, Twitter and Instagram is the best way to reach me.
Well, Dev, I say it's been great to have a chat this evening with you.
So
we'll do what we can here at Ucrefot 24 as well to help get the message out there. And good luck to you with this venture. A lot of respect for anybody that puts in the amount of work it takes to get a book to publish. Big congratulations to you already with where you are there. Say it's been great tonight. I'm Adam at Ucrefot24. You can also follow me on LinkedIn, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and all the other social platforms that I may have forgotten. So, all right. That's it for tonight, everybody. Thanks a lot for listening. Look forward to being back again sometime in the near future in another podcast for Shoot the Defense. Have a good evening and good night.